Hi everyone, and welcome to Four Panel, the Geek Show's dedicated comics and manga podcast. I'm your host, Andrew, and as per usual, I'm joined by my co-host, Rob.
Hello.
And Mick.
Hello.
So, how are we all doing today?
Well, I'm virus-free.
Well, that's summit, isn't it?
Yeah, along with about 69 million several hundred thousand of the population, but go on.
Yeah, and I'm sure all several million of us are very excited for the New Mutants next month.
The New Mutants who've been self-isolating for the last 3 years.
I mean, you couldn't make it up, could you?
No.
But what you could make up is a bunch of storylines and comics like the ones what we're going to be reviewing today.
Yes.
Smooth.
Yes.
Because we got lots of comics today.
Well, you have.
Well, yeah. I mean, collectively we have a lot of comics.
Yeah. I mean, you took the lion's share, clearly.
Yeah, but... Part of that lion's share is just absolute carnage.
I mean, I understand why, because lions traditionally can't read comics, so, you know, it was pointless handing them over to him in the first place, really.
Are you saying I need a haircut?
No, I'm saying you need to stop giving comics to lions to review.
Anyway, Rob, would you like to kick us off with some comic reviews this week?
Yes, Superior Spider-Man, which, it's automatic.
Is that the actual automatic?
And it's kind of... See, I don't understand what Marvel keeps doing. Superior Spider-Man starts off with the War of the Realms and Otto Octavius, or Superior Spider-Man, or whatever Tolliver his name is, Edwin Tolliver or something like that, starts off with War of the Realms and the Frost Giants have invaded San Francisco and he's fighting them and he wants the West Coast Avengers to come and help him, but he's not impressed by a bunch of them. Especially Gwenpool, who everyone thinks is quite mad because, you know, she's the only person who, aside from Deadpool, who realizes that world that they're in is complete fiction. But he wants...
And actually She-Hulk, I'll have you know.
She-Hulk as well?
Yeah, she's actually the character like pretty much invented the whole fourth wall breaking thing.
Oh yeah, she did, didn't she? But anyway... He is fascinated by America Chavez because she has dimensional jumping powers and things like that and can punch space apart or stars into space or whatever it is she does. So anyway, he wants her help to basically take the fight to the Frost Giants and to whoever else is attacking Earth. And
you mean she punches star-shaped portals in the space around her?
Yeah.
Because that was a sentence that had to be unpacked for a second.
It did, yeah. Punching stars into space. But hold on, that's where they already are.
So anyway, the first stop is New York, obviously, where they appear on a giant battle scene involving the Fantastic Four and a bunch of trolls. And Hawkeye turns up and tells Ben Grimm that it's clobbering time. And he's like, don't steal my catchphrase.
Which one?
Old, decrepit Hawkeye.
Oh, hot guy.
There's some really good bits in this. For example, Hawkeye telling Otto that, you know, he used to be a bad guy. And Otto gently reminding Hawkeye that Hawkeye also used to be a bad guy who became a good guy. At which point Hawkeye decides to shut up.
I feel like Hawkeye does get a modicum more respect than that. Because we need to remember, he is a bad guy. Who, as a man whose primary ability is shooting, like, pointy sticks.
Yeah.
Decided, you know who's going to be my arch enemy? Iron Man.
Yeah.
The most technically advanced superhero on the planet. I bet I can take him down with, like, sharp wood.
The first half of this is interesting because you have Quentin Quire just kind of giving his pithy commentary on things that Otto Octavius says. Like his catchphrase, the die is cast. And Quire's going, dude, is that your catchphrase? It's so bad, it's actually kind of awesome. And he's
very much how I feel about that phrase, to be honest.
Yeah, Quire's one of those characters in this who, literally, Quentin Quire is one of those Omega-level mutants, isn't he?
No.
Or is that when he's got the Phoenix?
He is, like, the level... below Omega, I think, which is maybe Alpha, which is not how the Greek alphabet works, but...
Yeah, but he is, like, ridiculously powerful, isn't he?
Yeah, he's on, like, the strong side.
So he could literally save the entire city if he wanted to, from the Frost Giants.
Maybe not that strong, I think. I mean, this is also, he is as strong as whoever is currently writing the comic says he is.
Yeah.
As with all comic book characters.
Yeah, which is one of the things that I don't like about superhero comics is the inconsistency in power levels. Superman should be the same strength that he is. You should know how strong he is. Or
unless we can buy kryptonite in some kind of plot device. Yeah.
But, you know, at least kryptonite is an established weakening device for Superman. But when you have a mutant who is supposed to be really powerful, but all of a sudden he's not as powerful and can't fight frost giants, you're like, well, hang on. He was like flipping tanks and cars and hulks and things like that.
Maybe they've just bred a better species of frost giant.
No.
Yeah, maybe they were just like, before it was the frost giants who hadn't had their cornflakes.
Yeah.
Weetabix, it's had his Weetabix, isn't it?
Yeah, that whole bit finishes with Tolliver, Otto Octavius, getting the key to the city, and then having to fight some guy who was revived to fight hipsters by Dormammu, which may or may not be a serious thing. Otto's going through a bit of an existential crisis because of all the people that died during the War of the Realms, and he's feeling really guilty about it. And I thought, okay, this is actually interesting. This is, you're pushing the character into an area where it makes the character actually grow and develop and, you know, challenges the character's mentality and challenges what you know about the character, right?
Indeed. This is interesting. However, stuff. I did also think you said he's having a crisis because of old people for a second.
See, it's interesting you say that because I don't like how this ended, and I will be honest, this was written by Christos Gage, and I'll be honest, I'm not impressed, Christos Gage, because you basically did... Otto Octavius as Superior Spider-Man is an interesting character who is struggling to be good when his basic nature is to be evil, to basically be high-handed and arrogant and full of himself, but he's struggling to be a good person, and he's slowly discovering what that means. But instead, you basically put him in a fight with Norman Osborn Spider-Man and Spider-Man and say, oh, right, the only way for Otto to win is to go back to being Dr. Octopus.
Yeah, well, okay, so what you need to understand is that Dr. Octopus, he's one of these characters who he could have been anything that he wanted to be, but really deep down, does it not make your heart glad that he's the very best at being bad guys?
Yeah, I know. And I'm
that
just,
was another Bugsy Malone reference. And I say another, I realised the first one I made was pre-show.
The artwork in this isn't bad. You know, Lan Medina has done the artwork, and Cam Smith's done the inks. Andy Troy and Erica Asiniega have done the colours. Letters by VCs Joe Caramagna and Travis Laddam. Rest of it's not bad, but, you know, Christos Gage, screw you. You ruined a good character. You ruined an interesting character by sending him back to being bloody Dr. Bloody Octopus. So screw you, Christos Gage.
Seems like a very, very aggressively anti-Dr. Octopus attitude you've got there.
Yeah. You've got, like I said, he's an evil character who's struggling to be good. You have a lot of potential there to actually develop really interesting, really fascinating, really challenging stories. But no, you basically retreat on that. You renege on all of that promise, and you basically go back to him just being a bad guy. Because that's what readers want, apparently. No, we don't bloody want that. We want something that is more interesting.
Also, on a note, we've just had a word from our lawyers. Other breakfast cereals are available.
Yeah, cheerio.
And there's your Weetos.
Yeah, just don't keep naming breakfast cereals, all right?
I don't know, I feel like that could be a fun new podcast. Andrew lists every breakfast cereal he remembers off the top of his head.
It would only be fun if we got free samples.
Okay, but what if all the free samples we get are just Rice Krispies? The worst breakfast cereal.
It's the most fun. Snap, crackle, and pop.
What if we were...
And then you have to eat it, and it's just mush.
What if we were so held back by the law that we couldn't name any breakfast cereal? We had to call it something like generic sugary rice cereal with added marshmallows.
What's that one?
Look, I'm just saying, if we rename the podcast to Serial, we'll get a lot more new, very confused listeners. Yeah. And we're just going, when are they going to start talking about the murders?
Yeah, but if we rename it to Serial, people will expect each episode to follow on from the last.
Anyway,
I mean,
who's
technically
next?
It does.
Who's next?
That is how the concept of time works, yeah. Nick.
No, I mean, thematically and with a plot of some kind. And as we all know, we lost the plot around episode 3.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair.
Okay. Boom. Andrew, you're next.
Oh, no. Now I have to do talking about things. You know I hate doing that. That's why I'm on a podcast. So, yeah, I have been reading Kino's Journey, The Beautiful World, Volume 5 by Haruka Shiomiya, original story by Keiichi Sugisawa, and original character designs by Kohaku Kuroboshi. It's getting almost passable, isn't it? I mean, Rob still looks down to the ground in absolute disgust whenever I open my mouth and try and say Japanese names.
I mean, to be fair, just look at you like that.
Not just Japanese names.
Anyway, Kino's Journey by those people, what I mentioned before, and I'm too afraid to mention again. So, yeah, this volume, again, features Kino visiting another land. This one to basically condense a long story short, this one called The Land of Kindness. Involves Kino visiting somewhere, and it's just a lovely place. Everyone's like really nice to her. They give her free stuff. She gets a new gun, which was a bit confusing, because I think it's the gun that you see her having in some of the previous chapters. So I guess a lot of these stories are maybe like non-linear, which, to be fair, works because there's nothing really like connecting them. Mm. But I guess I just maybe could have used literally even just like big words saying this one is a flashback.
Yeah, it can be a bit confusing.
Yeah, and the main kind of big thing in the story is there's mention of a mysterious woman known only as the Master, who, yeah, I guess is trying to, I don't know, bring some Cybermen back or something. But no, this is a person who kind of, they ask Kino if they know about her, and Kino is like very obviously lying and says no. And it turns out this is maybe the person kind of taught Kino everything they know about surviving in the wasteland and shrinking people down into miniature figures.
Like all the best masters do.
Yeah. I'm going to stop this joke now because I realise I cannot off the top of my head remember anything the master's done, like, beyond the most recent series of Doctor Who. He wore a dog collar once, remember that.
He turned Doctor Who into something that looked like a house elf from Harry Potter.
Yes.
That's right, that was David Tennant. Anyway, then, much like many Kino's Journey stories, there's a really sad and depressing ending to it.
Nice. Even in the Land of Kindness.
Oh, yeah, definitely in the Land of Kindness. We then actually get to meet this, you know, the master character, and that's where we find out that she's the one who kind of trained Kino a bit. And there's a fun bit at the end, where like the final story is called The Land of Masks, where it's actually told of like three separate time periods, because we've now got like a group of characters. So the first one is about the master visiting a land where basically people are too embarrassed to look at each other. And she kind of semi as a joke suggests, well, I've got some masks that you pick up, I'll happily sell them to you, you can just start wearing those. And like, yeah, just kind of makes a bit of money, drives off. Then years later, Kino comes by and finds that, like, this is a land where now everyone wears really elaborate masks that are actually really cool. They're, like, basically sort of like human faces. And they've got, like, twizzly dials on the side that you can use to, like, change the expressions. So, like, basically, if you've got a neutral expression, someone tells a joke, you're, like, you twizzle the thing, and then it goes, smiley face. I realise I shouldn't have said that while also pulling my mouth up to make a smiley face. Look, one of these days, I'll get the hang of the whole audio medium thing. Not today. And anyway, then like, and I guess maybe a few months later, Riku, who is someone that Kino met in a previous story, he also goes to the Land of Masks. And kind of him being like the kind of sort of prince of a realm, he's very, well, this is clearly a problem. I'm going to try and convince everyone to take off their masks. And he does. And finds that basically, because they've been wearing these masks for years and not basically using their face muscles, They've got like weird, smooth, atrophied faces.
Oh.
Because like, obviously, they've haven't been using their mouth muscles to like smile or frown at anything. So they're just like a flat line. It is actually quite creepy to look at. Bleh, indeed. Yeah, and I like this idea that you've now got like multiple travelers, and so you can have all of them go to the same place and sort of see how it changes over the years.
That's actually a really interesting idea. Mm. There's not many manga that actually do that.
It is, especially as I was getting to the point where, to be honest, I was starting to maybe think, oh, I've probably pretty much seen all that Kino's journey has to offer. Like, it's just going to be more, Kino goes to a place, there's some kind of like nice, fairly calm adventure. Maybe it's a bit sad and that's it. And I like that they've, you know, kind of found a way to mix it up a bit more.
Cool.
So well played, creative team. And in honor of that, I'm not going to butcher your names again. So you know who you are. Give yourselves a pat on the back.
So it's my turn to butcher names now.
Yes. It
is indeed.
Okay. So I've got Captain Marvel Falling Star, which collects together issues 6 to 11 of Captain Marvel from last year. And it was written by Kelly Thompson, Anna Paolo Martello, and Carmen Carnera were the artists, with colours by Tamara Bonvillain. Drumroll. Applause.
Golf clap.
Yeah, it was all right. Actually, you know, I'm surprised that colourist wasn't delayed with the rest of No Time to Die.
Oh, dear. And the letters are by VC's Clayton Cowles. So this one starts off with Carol getting involved in the War of the Realms, blah-de-blah-de-blah, goes to Rio de Janeiro, which has been taken over by the Enchantress, blah-de-blah-de-blah. They figure out a way to stop that, blah-de-blah-de-blah, War of the Realms.
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel about it now as well.
This one at least has a really nice twist in how they defeat Enchantress.
Yeah.
Which I won't give away, but it's like, oh yeah, blah, 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 blah. Oh, hold on, that cat. Oh, ah. Oh, yeah. Oh, I see.
I mean, I feel like in general, this is just a problem with like tie-ins to big events, isn't it? Where it's just, there is a big thingy-majig, we've got to go fight it for a while.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get back to the actual story now.
Yeah, and this is it. So that sort of ties up the first couple of issues. And then we get on to the one that's actually a Captain Marvel story. And it's kind of treading old ground, because I'm sure some of this happened in the previous collection that I covered, which included Nuclear Man kidnapping everybody and taking them to an island in New York. And it was about depowering women and depowering Captain Marvel in particular. This one is just about depowering Captain Marvel.
There you go. It's completely different.
There's an involvement from Minerva, who's highlighted as being a potential bad guy, but actually turns out to be an ally.
Ooh, and then she dies and joins the Eternals.
Ooh, spoiler alert. I didn't know that.
That was it was a not very good joke about Gemma Chan.
Mm. Well, okay. So, it's quite a neat little story. Someone from Captain Marvel's recent past has been seeded with a device that allows her to absorb Carol's power and actually becomes more of a hero.
So basically Rogue.
Kind of, but doesn't actually sap her powers, the individual sort of skills she has, just her general energy level, if you like, power level.
Okay.
Whereas Rogue is more a direct, if you can turn invisible, she touches you, she can turn invisible. This is more.
So this new one just, what, gets a peppiness, get up and go.
Yeah, basically. gets her fortification of iron and 6 other vitamins.
Learns how to start her day, right, with a nice a nice bowl full of all, Bran.
So the other thing is there's a little bit of coverage of this almost sort of Donald Trump-style, Brexiteer-style xenophobia in that it gets released to the press that she's part alien, she gets robbed of her military rank. She gets kicked out of the military. And then you suddenly start getting all these campaigns of send Captain Marvel home and stuff like that. All focusing on the half-Kree part and ignoring the half-human part.
Yeah, and it's also, it feels like one of those things, even more than, like, with the X-Men, I can kind of be okay with it, but, like, surely there's characters like Thor, who are on the Avengers with the Captain Marvel, who's literally, like, basically an alien from another planet.
Yeah,
yeah.
So it doesn't kind of hold water. It's been done better elsewhere.
That's kind of what I was on about with this, with the Superior Spider-Man one. Yeah. It's that manufactured drama that they try and ram down your throat that I hate.
Yeah. And I think the problem is, for me with this, is by this point in Carol's story, she's well known enough by the general populace that that minority of people who would think like that wouldn't drive the whole country to behave that way.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, yeah, exactly.
It'd still be little pockets. It wouldn't be a whole movement. So it's a little bit hammer to smash a metaphorical walnut.
Yeah, it's definitely, they have like thought of the metaphor first and tried to sort of find a way to smash that into the story.
So as for the core story of this ordinary person who's got this device inside them that can sap Carol's powers, that's quite a nice little story. I just feel that every Captain Marvel story I'm reading at the moment is about someone trying to nick Carol's powers.
Because apparently Carol is really powerful.
Yeah.
Like, ridiculously powerful. Yeah. The strongest on planet Earth. Nobody is stronger than Carol Danvers, so only Carol Danvers' powers can be nicked.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, let's face it, you wouldn't really want Steve Rogers's, would you? I mean, they're basically just like, you know.
Yeah, but my point is, if you can see...
I mean, if you did, you probably would get his incredible ability to grow a beard.
Yeah.
Here's my point. If you can steal the powers of one superhero, it means you can steal the powers from the majority of superheroes. So why wouldn't you go around nicking the powers from other superheroes?
You say that like this is not completely made up science and there's hard rules to it.
Yeah. But I mean, you're right in a point, you know. This is a device that saps someone's ability to have abilities rather than the abilities themselves. Right?
Yeah.
So it's like, if you absorb the power from the Hulk, you wouldn't turn into the Hulk every time you got angry. You'd just have their vim and vigor.
See, what you just said reminded me of one of those stupid lines from one of those movies. What's your dream? To have a dream.
Yeah. And that's almost what this is. This isn't about envying Captain Marvel per se. This is just about envying power. And
yeah,
there is a little note in there of this sort of, and I kind of guess it's a parallel to the whole Me Too thing. You know, yes, it's easy for someone who's got some power in Hollywood, like a Kate Beckinsale or someone like that, to speak up against a Harvey Weinstein or something. But for the girl who works in an office in Middlesbrough, whose boss has been sort of inappropriate towards her, not quite so easy for her to stand up and point the finger. So there is an element of that, and I think that's a more serious message that could have come to the fore more than the whole xenophobic bigotry thing.
Yes,
which,
damn it, we were fine with you when you were just a normal human being who could fly and shoot laser beams, but a half alien who can fly and shoot laser
that's
beams.
That's just wrong. That's anti-American, that is. So I think what they've done is they've overemphasized the wrong elements in this. The artwork's good. It's kind of confusing that the covers don't bear any relevance to any costume that she wears between the pages, but hey-ho, because comics, right?
Yep.
It is. I mean, I just hope one day they settle on what is Carol Danvers' hairstyle, because I feel like she has about 15 across all the titles she's in.
She does. I mean, there are three things that I'd really like them to kind of finalise about Carol Danvers. Hairstyle is one. How long is that bloody sash? Is another.
I mean,
it's actually quite short, but in other pictures, it's like ridiculously long.
I've got a theory.
It's basically a wedding train.
It is, yeah. I've got a theory about the sash. I think it's the offspring of the cloak that Stephen Strange wears.
Ooh, what you mean, like the offcuts that have just...
Yeah. Whoever made that cloak.
That's interesting. That cloak. I like that. But the other thing that I want them to kind of finalise about Carol Danvers is, what exactly is her power? What exactly does she have as powers?
Well, flying.
Aside from the flying and the strength...
And the photon blasts.
But apparently she's got other abilities, which I've seen her have in other comics. And I'm like, when did she get those? It's like, you know how we did that episode about the weird powers of Superman? It's like they've been going through this cycle with...
Does Carol Danvers also have super dancing?
Yes.
Excellent.
Yes, she did do dancing in one of the comics I read. I think it might have been when I did the True Believers one.
Oh, are we going to have to do an episode on the weird powers of Captain Marvel now?
Actually, you know what? I'm going to disagree with you, Rob. Because if there is a comic in which Captain Marvel shoots a tiny Captain Marvel out of her hand, I will read that.
But how do you know the original Captain Marvel didn't?
I mean, I'm going to assume he didn't, because he was very boring.
Yeah, but so was Superman for a long time.
I think you're using the wrong tense for Superman there.
For a long time, Superman is boring.
I disagree. I like Superman.
Yeah, but you're wrong.
He's a nice bloke. Which, I mean, I guess I can understand why that makes you two hate him.
Yeah.
Anyway. Me next, isn't it?
Is it because he's like about the same age as you, but he looks much better?
No, Superman's way older than Mick.
Way older than me. And
way older.
Born in the 1920s, Mick.
No, I wasn't.
The 1910s?
I just look like I was.
Anyway. I have a manga here by Umi Sakurai called A Man and His Cat. And yes, that is a depiction of said cat. Right.
Drawn clearly by a man who has never seen a cat.
Well, I think Umi is a woman.
Drawn by a woman who has clearly... The point is about never having seen a cat.
Yeah, but someone has had a cat described to them.
Well, I think it's supposed to be like a stylized cat more than anything else. And the whole point of it is that this older gentleman, he's still working and everything like that, but he's a much older gentleman. Probably around Mick's age, maybe older. And
what? Mid-30s?
Born turn of the century, yeah.
He was married, but his wife passed away. And before his wife passed away, she told him, don't be by yourself. Find someone or a pet or something that you can basically keep you company. And so he goes to this pet shop where this cat has been left because it's so ugly. It's the ugliest cat in the pet shop. The rest of the cats have been drawn to be cute and fluffy and everything like that.
That does explain the drawing on the cover.
Yeah, but this one cat is there. And initially, he's like all the other kittens. He's excited about the people looking through the cage at him and looking through the windows at him. And he's excited to go with them, but he doesn't understand human language. But all he knows is that they keep walking away and they keep walking away and they keep walking away. And as time goes on, the kitten becomes more and more depressed until he hears the voice of this man saying, I want this cat. And it's actually a really sweet story about a guy who's going through the grieving process and a cat that's basically been all but abandoned by everybody, and how the two of them come to rely on each other to try and just get through the day. It's really nice. It's really sweet.
And then the cat gets murdered by Russian gangsters, and so the man just gets a sledgehammer and smashes up his floor and goes on a roaring rampage of revenge.
Thankfully, this isn't John Wick and this isn't Taken or anything like that.
How dare you say, thankfully, this isn't John Wick. Everything should be John Wick.
I don't know. I don't think it would work with the Waltons.
Or would it work too well?
Possibly too well. I have a soft spot for this type of story because it's a big departure from what you see a lot of in manga. It's not trying to be a romantic story. It's not trying to... It's what they call slice of life. And slice of life usually is very calming, very soothing. It has very placid storylines. Usually they're quite episodic. But I have a soft spot for them because there's a lot of the action-packed, you know, sex and violence type manga out there. There's a lot of the high school romantic comedy manga out there. There's a lot of stories where they try and drive up the drama and the tension. And these are just kind of a nice little rinse the mind out and just let it become calm. You know, it's a nice, gentle story that's actually, if you ignore the fact that the cat is drawn like that, it's actually really well drawn. The characters are really expressive.
Yeah, well, I think we can say it's well drawn now that we know it's meant to be a weird, weird-looking cat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I like about it is it doesn't try to challenge you in any real way. It just says, look, this is a simple story. It's very straightforward, but that's actually part of its charm. So, yeah, I reckon you might like this one, Mick.
No, it's got a cat in it.
I know it's got a cat in it, but... I know it's got a cat in it, but you could replace...
If it was about an ugly dog, I'd do it. I'd go.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. You could easily replace the cat with a dog.
I couldn't easily replace it because I can't draw.
Yeah, but you've got Tipex.
That's why I read things that other people have drawn.
Anyway, Andrew.
I mean, if anything, if you just replace all the words with dog, it's even better because then you can look at that and go, wow, that is an ugly-looking dog.
Yeah, but then, as you've already mentioned several times, I'm getting on a bit, and sometimes I forget things. So what about on those odd occasions where I forget to replace the cat with a dog, and then I go, where's this bloody cat suddenly come from?
See,
Mick, right, and just the illusion is shattered, and Mick, just threw it in the bin.
Mick didn't see the unhanded compliment I just paid him there, when I said he might like this, because I described this as an older, distinguished gentleman.
Yeah, what you're forgetting is that you might have stuck in the word distinguished,
you are.
But the focus was definitely on the word older.
I mean, that's what we all want out of fiction, isn't it? Something we can aspire to. Yeah.
And if you two carry on, older is not something you should aspire to.
Anyway, from a man and his cat to a man and his sword.
Yeah, sure, why not? Specifically, the savage sword of Conan.
As opposed to one of those, like, well-cultured swords.
The older distinguished sword.
And it's pet cat, yes.
Also, we're talking about Kazan, no?
He says, oh, man, I should not have worn gloves, but fine. So this is a collection of issues 6 to 11 of Savage Sword of Conan, subtitled Conan the Gambler, and... kind of going to have to go through them sort of one at a time. There's three separate stories because this is sort of an anthology with different creative teams. So issue 6 was written by Meredith Finch with art by Luke Ross, colours by Nolan Woodard. And it's something that it's been a while since I've seen in an ongoing comic, which is just a full-on filler issue.
Really?
Yeah, so it's a simple... one-off story where Conan, some guy whose uncle he murdered, drugs his beer. He wakes up, finds he's been kidnapped and forced into some kind of slave ship, which, I mean, is one of, like, the three accepted Conan plots.
I was going to say, is that, like, Conan wakes up and he's a slave again. He's like, oh, not again.
Slave again. Must be Tuesday.
But this time, I did enjoy the setup for this story. Which is that he's basically been forced into a gladiatorial contest.
What, again?
I know, again.
Wednesday.
And the idea is, it's like, it's a bunch of nobles who are all competing for, like, the hand of a princess. And it's like, this princess, she single-handedly conquered her own kingdom. And so she said, right, basically, like, you're all going to fight to the death, and the survivor, that's the guy worthy of marrying me. But first, just, I don't know, kill these prisoners for warm-up. And so, of course, you know, Conan has to kill his way out of there. With the added wrinkle that he's still drugged to start with, and so can, like, barely move his body. And that bit's fun. Where it's like Conan trying to fight a guy even though he can't really stand up. And just sort of, like, tricking him into tripping over and stabbing him in the face with a sword that he's just, like, awkwardly prodding up. But then it's just, yeah, then Conan gets his strength back, grabs a sword. Fights everyone, wins, because he's the best at fighting.
Does he marry the princess? Become king?
No, it's not Thursday yet.
I was going to say...
there was a fun bit at the end where it kind of describes Conan sort of climbing up to where the princess is to claim his prize, only to, like, grab the necklace that she's got next to her and run off.
Excellent.
So that is Thursday then.
Yeah, that's Thursday.
Then we get to kind of the main story, the Conan the Gambler story, which is written by Jim Zub with art by Patch Zercher and covers by Jara Tartaglia.
I've met him, you know, Jim Zub.
Ah.
Hmm. Animex. He was a regular at Animex.
Good for him. He comes across like a pretty nice guy.
Yeah.
I think we might still have a Samurai Jack poster signed by him.
That's right. I did like his Samurai Jack comics.
Anyway, Conan.
I'm not a fan of a lot of his superhero stuff, though. So, yeah, this one...
You're in luck. Conan's not a superhero.
You're right, he's not. So, in this story, Conan comes across a merchant being accosted by muggers. And so, I say saves him, kind of, you know, just sees a fight.
I was about to say, in the world of Conan, isn't that, you know, if Conan had like an RPG thing, isn't it... A, help him. B, join in. C, rob the robbers.
Yeah, I feel like it's less save this guy, more. It looks like it's going to be more fun to fight these guys, so I'll fight them. And also this other guy can pay me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and then from there he gets kind of sucked into this world, kind of seedy underground. But, I mean, this is Shadazar, so that's as opposed to the seedy overground.
And you say sucked in, but it's more like Conan arrogantly sorted in.
Yeah, but sucked in by a man saying, hey, if you come with me, I'll pay you even more money. It's not exactly the most complex of ruses.
Exactly.
And it turns out this guy is heavily in debt to the local casino and is going to, like, basically gamble his way to freedom and is actually doing a pretty good job until, dun, 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 he's poisoned and dies.
Friday.
Exactly. And it turns out, as per the rules of the casino, all his debts now fall on Conan, and he has to basically gamble his way out to pay off the debts.
That's a harsh casino, isn't it? That your debts fall to the hired help.
I mean, it's pretty in keeping with the world of Conan, though, isn't it?
Yeah. I was going to say, it's pretty in keeping with the world of casinos.
And again, like the first story, this is one that starts off, it's quite interesting, and I'm really into it, because it's like, it's Conan in the sort of situation he's not used to. Like, you know, he has a select set of skills, mostly drinking, fighting, thieving, and none of those can help him.
No, he's got one other skill, but we don't talk about that one.
That's more a hobby than a skill, I think. But then, like, the other one, it just devolves into, okay, now Conan's got to fight a big monster and then just kill a bunch of people. And he does that because he's the best at fighting. It's just a bit of a boring way to always end the stories. The last one I liked a lot more, though, it was The Cave of the Dark Crystal, which is written by Roy Thomas, who I believe he wrote the original Conan comics like in the 70s.
I think he did.
Yeah. And more like with art by Alan Davis, one of the greatest comics artists ever born, Alan Davis, with inks by Cam Smith and colours by Chris Sotomayor. Like, it's a proper old school Conan gets roped into a quest to, like, go into a cave and find a magic crystal, and there's bandits, and everyone betrays each other, and there's monsters and cave-ins, and fights that Conan doesn't actually win. So there's, like, stakes.
Ah, we've hit the weekend.
Yeah, this is kind of like casual shirt Conan.
Dressed down Conan.
Well, no, it's TGIF Conan, isn't it?
Actually, that's a point. Does dressed down Conan, in fact, have to put more clothes on?
Yeah, he has to put tracky bottoms on over the top of his loincloth.
I mean, you know, he goes home and plays a healthy game of lawyers and accountants.
Yeah, I like it because it's got this like very fun moment where it turns out Conan's deliberately gone on this quest to meet the mountain bandits, because he knows they have a code where if he challenges the leader to a one-on-one duel and he wins, like, those bandits, they'll be his army. Except also they're bandits. So what happens is he walks up and goes, you, leader, I challenge you to a duel. And he just goes, nah. And as his men drop a big net on Conan.
Yeah.
And then also he gets like, basically tied to a tree, and it's going to be like, we'll just leave you to starve to death. Only for Conan to, like, rip the branches off the tree and just use them as, like, clubs. That's a good Conan moment, isn't it?
Yeah, always a good Conan moment. This story sounds like the more typical Conan story, where Conan basically goes in, all guns blazing, thinking, you know, I'm cock of the walk, and just basically brute strengths his way through a problem.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, it shows there's a distinct difference between, oh no, this is a bad situation, I'm just going to have to, like, keep punching and hope for the best, and this is a bad situation, whatever, I can just kill all of them because I'm Conan, I'm the best.
Yeah.
And then that brings me on, because I've actually got two Conan books, because I've also been reading Age of Conan Valeria, which was written by Meredith Finch, remember her? Art by Aneki, colours by Andy Troy, and letters by VC's Travis Lanham. And Mick, you know when I got these books and you saw Conan the Gambler and you made some joke about there being like an extended Conan multiverse?
Yeah.
We've got like Conan the Barbarian, Conan the Gambler, and I guess that makes this girl Conan. Yeah, this is girl Conan.
You said Age of Conan. Is this a video game related thing?
I don't think so. I think it's just Age of Conan is like the general term for Conan stories, but Conan isn't the main character.
I think Age of Conan is it's like a literary version of a cinematic universe, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. That explains a lot, because whenever I see Age of Conan, I'm thinking, well, he's not that old, is he?
Yeah, Age of Conan, you just open up and says, he's about 23. But yeah, so Age of Conan Valeria. There's a reason I've kind of just tacked this on to the end of Conan the Gambler, which is because, to be honest, I didn't get through it. I read about an issue and a half. Because it's just Valeria, she's like, eventually becomes some kind of mercenary, I think, and meets Conan. But before that, she was just a woman who was also the best at fighting. And her brother's been killed, and she's going to find the mysterious cloaked figure who did it. And is it going to turn out to be someone who's close to her and be a big thingamajig? You bet it is.
A big thingamajig, you say?
A big thingamajig.
Please, Mr. Conan Expert, I just want to ask, isn't that just Red Sonja?
Isn't that just one of, like, I mean, I've talked about the three Conan plots. There's three Conan plots, but there's also only, like, five general fantasy plots.
Yeah.
Which are, we got to find the thing or destroy the thing to defeat the villain. Ragtag group of adventurers go looking for treasure. Court intrigue. Wizards who want to smooch each other. Or, got to find someone who killed a family member.
I've also noticed with Conan, there's only like really five different types of leading female character. There's the sexy magic.
That many?
Yeah, there's the sexy magic user. There's the sexy swordswoman. There's the sexy slave girl. They're all sexy for some reason.
I mean, it's the costumes,
yeah,
mainly.
There's the sexy pirate.
One thing I'll tell you about the Age of Conan, material was at a premium. Cloth was very difficult to come by.
That might explain why everybody's always getting off with everybody in the Conan stories.
One of the things that I've always found with Conan-related material, and fantasy-related material in general... is that cloth was hard to come by, and the women folk had a lot to cover with not very much material.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and the sexy priestess, that's the other one.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess in a fun subversion of typical fantasy, Valeria is the one who gets to wear like a full shirt and trousers, and Conan is just the one who's got a... I mean, it's a merkin, isn't it? Let's just call a merkin a merkin.
It's very underpants, isn't it? Merkin a
merkin. But yeah, no.
What you don't want is a merkin with a mouth.
But no, Valeria, it's just so much this is the most generic fantasy of generic fantasies. And that is, like, probably the thing I hate more than anything else when it comes to fiction.
And the sad thing is that, you know, Conan's more one of the progenitors of the fantasy genre, so for it to have descended into a generic piece of fantasy is probably
And
sad.
I mean, I feel like that's a kind of a bit of a problem I have with Conan in general, is it's very much, I can see things that like lots of other properties have taken and spun off more.
Yeah.
And while I can appreciate that, okay, this is the franchise that kicked them all off, it's the John Carter problem.
Yeah.
Of where, because you're going back to the original, it seems a bit derivative.
Yeah.
And this is like a derivation of a derivation.
Written by somebody who probably doesn't really... I wouldn't say they understand the source material that much, or maybe they understand it too much.
I think it's easy to sort of look at something like Conan or stories set within Conan's world and think, oh yeah, I know what that is. But what you're actually channeling is all the sort of...
all the crap that, spun off. Yeah. That's what I mean when I say they don't understand it enough. Mm. But then you've got the other angle where they understand it a bit too much. And
it becomes impenetrable because you don't have all the background.
Exactly, yeah.
Actually, I guess also that's probably another problem with this, is that Valeria, I don't know who this character is.
Yeah.
And I feel like from the start, there's a bit of an undercurrent is, it's Valeria, you know Valeria, everyone loves Valeria.
See, I mean, to me, it sounds more like it's Red Sonja, but we didn't have the rights to use Red Sonja. So we've made her blonde, put more clothes on her, and called her Valeria.
Actually, yeah, that probably is just they've gone, right, let's go through the old Conan books. Who's a character who's a bit like Red Sonja? Then we can make the next Red Sonja. Yeah. The Inhumans to Red Sonja's X-Men.
You mean Valeria's getting her own short-lived and ill-advised TV show?
Oh, I hope so. I can't wait for the episode where, like, she can see a few seconds into the future and yet still falls down a hill and loses her powers because she bumps her head.
Or the episode where she's the best sword fighter and someone then just hides all her swords for the rest of the show.
Yes. Or the one where she forgets that she can't swim and starts wading into the ocean.
So, Mick, you've got something that looks interesting.
I have got something that is very interesting.
Okay.
This is Aero Before the Storm. And no, I am not name-dropping chocolate bars.
Is it orange or mint?
Right, this is, it's my turn to, and I'm going to use this as a strand on the show, it's my turn to do an Andrew.
Do an Andrew?
Yeah, so this was written by...
Horribly mispronounced the names.
Oh, God, this should be good.
For seconds, I thought, wow, I finally made some kind of positive impact. But no.
So this was written by Zhao Lifen, artwork by Keng, and the adaptation is by Greg Pak. Letters are by VC's Joe Caramagna. And Keng did the cover art. And what I like about the art in this is it's like Western manga.
Yeah.
So it's... the characters are all very manga-esque, but the backgrounds still feel like familiar Marvel territory.
Yeah.
It's set in Shanghai, and basically it's not an origin story for Aero. Aero's one of the agents of Atlas, this sort of eastern wing of the Marvel universe.
Is she Chinese hero or Korean hero?
She's Chinese.
Okay.
She's an architect. She operates in Shanghai.
Okay.
And she sees Shanghai as her city to protect. But it's a much more, you know, like you see Daredevil and Spider-Man talking about New York being their city, they'll protect it. But it's a much more sort of power-based thing. Yeah. I am the most powerful person in the city, I'm going to protect this. This feels more spiritual. And that's the thing that comes across through this. So, yes, Aero is a superhero. She has a secret identity during the day. She's Lai Ling, the architect. She has a boyfriend who doesn't know she's Aero. The people love Aero because she protects the city. She's got wind powers. She's basically the last airbender, but as a comic book hero. And she can control the wind and she can use air streams to detect things and stuff. But the this is my city and I will protect it thing feels more spiritual because of that elemental element.
Yeah.
So it's like she can sense, not that the people of the city are in danger necessarily, but that the fabric of the city is in danger. Mm. And the theme is constant throughout both her hero and her everyday identity. So when she's designing her buildings, she designs them in a way that enhance Shanghai completely and utterly, not in a way that just makes more money for developers.
Yeah.
And this is not an origin story. She already exists. There's already a bit of reference to things that have happened in War of the Realms and Agents of Atlas. It's a standalone story for just Aero, and it's wonderful. I really enjoyed it.
Cool. Oh, nice.
We even come into contact with a nemesis for Aero called Madame Huang, who's a former mentor of both Aero and Li Lang. It's beautifully drawn. It's a really good story. It has some original twists on the superhero mentality. And I'm looking forward to seeing more of Aero. Now, in a forthcoming episode, I'll be reviewing Agents of Atlas. So, spoiler alert there. But this, if the other standalone comics of Agents of Atlas are as good as this, it's going to be a really interesting series.
Yeah, but I feel like you're a real comic book fan now, because it's all about finding a character you like and then realizing, oh, I'm going to have to read all these really crap comics to get more.
Yeah.
But that, I mean, if there was like three more volumes of this, I'd be more than happy. The Agents of Atlas one that I'm kind of three quarters of the way through, and it's like, oh, I've seen the X-Men do this.
It's interesting you say that, because it's that age-old problem when you've got teams of superheroes. You can't really, unless it's like a big event, you can't really tell an interesting story from like 1 week to the next or 1 month to the next. You need a big event to try and tell a team story. And so a lot of us do exactly what Andrew just said. We latch onto a hero that we really like and follow their thread, you know, because that's always more interesting.
Yeah. But yeah, I can thoroughly recommend Aero, especially if you're, I would say this falls in with something like Wayward, where you can use it as a gateway into getting into manga. It's not just got the aesthetic, it's got that sort of spiritual feel to it as well.
Yeah. Right, so my turn, and we're going to end today's episode with absolute carnage.
Oh, so much of it.
There is so much of it.
Just before Rob starts, it's worth mentioning to listeners that this episode is available in 14 separate volumes.
Right. So anyway, thankfully we didn't get sent
We should make this half of the show like Patreon exclusive.
We didn't get sent all of Absolute Carnage because there are lots of other Absolute Carnage volumes dealing with individual heroes. But we did get The Amazing Spider-Man Absolute Carnage, which is Amazing Spider-Man 2018 issues 29 to 31 and Red Goblin Red Death number 1. We got Venom Absolute Carnage, which is Venom 2018 issues 16 to 20. We got Deadpool Absolute Carnage, or Absolute Carnage versus Deadpool, which collects Absolute Carnage versus Deadpool 1 to 3, Absolute Carnage Captain Marvel, and we got Absolute Carnage, which is the standalone volume, which collects Absolute Carnage 1 to 5 and Free Comic Book Day 2019 Spider-Man Venom number 1.
I don't know why Marvel always do this. I'll have a brief moment of thinking, oh, you know what, Carnage is not that bad, actually. They can do some fun kind of Lovecraftian horror type stuff with him. Which I swear some kind of Marvel exec overhears me and says, right, we need a million Carnage comics right now.
Yeah. See, this is coming off the back of me covering the Venomverse stuff. And the Venomverse stuff was bizarre and weird, and he ended up with a symbiote dragon and all sorts of stuff like that, and dealing with the god Knull, who is at the heart of the symbiote planet but trapped by the symbiotes because he's a real bad dude. And
trapped
this
by the symbiotes, that's going to hurt.
Yeah. But at least he was just trapped by them and not grabbed by them.
In order to trap him.
So anyway,
just got a big zipper and just got it right in there.
I'm actually going to use the actual standalone Absolute Carnage as the basis for all of them, since they do all overlap with each other. In the Venomverse comics and in the main Venom storyline, they have been foreshadowing this whole idea that Carnage is back, that Cletus Kasady is back, and that he's still alive. Carnage is still around, and Carnage is somehow connected to the god Knull, Is it Knull or Null?
I always say Null. And just assume it's a silent K, like a no.
See, I go with Knull because I'm just thinking about how comic book writers think, and I'm just thinking they probably want us to pronounce the K because it sounds more alien like that.
No, I think if they wanted it to sound more alien, they'd have put an apostrophe after the K.
Yeah, yeah, I feel like Knull would be K apostrophe N-U-L-L.
That's the standard way of denoting an alien word.
Oh, actually, no, you are probably right. I've just been thinking in terms of comic book humor, right? Comic book writer humor, not comic book humor. Let me get it right. Because the god, Null, is the god of the void. He's the god of darkness before light. And so calling him the god Null, but putting a K on the front, but pronouncing it Null, Null and Void.
Yeah,
it's the kind of joke that comic book writers would come up
rascal
with.
Rascal Donny Cates.
So, yeah. Anyway, Absolute Carnage, you've mentioned Donny Cates, and yes, it is written by Donny Cates, with the main Absolute Carnage having art by Ryan Stegman, inks by J.P. Mayer, Jay Leiston, and Ryan Stegman, colours by Frank Martin, and flashbacks by Mark Bagley and John Dell, and letters by VCs Clayton Cowles. I'm not going to go through all of them for the rest, because you only need to know mainly about the main Absolute Carnage. So, yeah. They've foreshadowed in the Venom series that Carnage is back and that he's going around killing people. They find a mass grave. And this kind of starts off with Eddie Brock, who's basically been caught by the police, and he's trying to convince the police that that Null is coming and Carnage is back and that he's not crazy. He knows all this stuff. But he eventually gets sent to prison, where he immediately turns into this red symbiote and starts executing all of the prisoners, including a guy who used to have a symbiote. And the guy who used to have a symbiote says, please don't take my symbiote. But Eddie takes it anyway and kills him. So what's happened? Turns out it's not Eddie. It's Cletus. And Cletus is here, and he's framing Eddie for a lot of things, because Eddie and his symbiote are daddy. And Cletus has daddy issues. But Cletus has a new daddy now, which is the god Null. And so he needs the bits from his old daddy to waken his new daddy.
You know, there are...
I think this was an old EastEnders plot.
Yeah, that's my point. It is basically an old EastEnders plot, but with more tentacles. Because not only is that happening, but Eddie actually has his son, who's convinced that Eddie is his older brother.
Yes, yes. It's just... On Tinternet, when the youths say someone is daddy,
yeah,
it can mean something very different, Rob.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Cletus keeps calling Eddie daddy, and he's using that, using it in that way as kind of a derogatory term in that way. Because he says, hello, daddy, and things like that. Because Carnage is the spawn of Venom. You have lots of things going on. But the thing is, Eddie doesn't want Venom anymore, because Venom's gone off and he's basically been doing his own thing. Venom is just, the symbiote has basically taken on human form, has been doing his own thing. But now the symbiote senses that the god Null is going to be awakened and wants Eddie to team up with him to go out and kill all the other former symbiote users. And there's a lot of them, including a lot of heroes from people who were infected with symbiotes during the Venomverse incident. And you have this kind of race against time to find the symbiote users before Cletus Cassidy does. And Cletus has been going around infecting a lot of people with Carnage, with the spawn of Carnage. Yeah, you remember that symbiote dragon from the Venomverse incident? They kind of lost what happened to that. What happened to it was that Carnage got his hands on it, which is not a good idea, because that gave Carnage the ability to mass reproduce his symbiote and infect lots of people, including lots of killers, and Norman Osborn. So, yeah, everyone's in a fight for their lives against Absolute Carnage, which has started infecting the city and potentially the world as well.
Is this basically a metaphor for coronavirus?
It's bizarre that it's bizarre that it's actually so timely, because I'm going to come back to Absolute Carnage in a second, but you have these overlapping stories, as you do with any crossover, like The Amazing Spider-Man, which is interesting because it starts off with Spider-Man kind of standing up MJ on a date, but there's this ongoing narrative of Spider-Man's history with Harry Osborn and Norman Osborn, why Norman Osborn hates him so much, everything like that. And all of it is kind of in the process of a fight where Spider-Man is trying to protect Norman Osborn's grandson and Eddie Brock's son from the Carnage symbiote, in particular, the Norman Osborn Carnage. So he's trying to protect those two kids from Norman Osborn as Carnage, and he's getting the crap kicked out of him because Spider-Man versus Carnage, it's obvious who's going to win.
And that's why you always wash your hands.
Yeah. but then it goes on to a story of Norman Osborn as Carnage as the Red Goblin. But then it goes on further onto a story of Norman Osborn's grandson as Kid Red Goblin, or whatever you called him.
Roblin and Croblin. It's not.
It's a bit of a strange one, the Amazing Spider-Man issue of Absolute Carnage. But then the Venom one is, well, it's a lot more straightforward because it connects more directly with Absolute Carnage because Venom and Carnage kind of go hand in hand. But this one is a bit of an eye on
it. There's an image for you.
Not an image I want.
Sorry, kind of go tentacle in tentacle.
Yeah, but I was about to say, kind of go more tentacle in tentacle. This is the thing. Eddie has a son.
Yes, called Carnage.
No, his actual human son, called Dylan, I think it was. Because Carnage, this mass grave that they find in Absolute Carnage, is basically it's mainly former symbiote users, including Eddie Brock's former girlfriend and Dylan's mum. That's what they think, but they don't find her body. So potentially she's still alive, maybe. They don't cover that in this, though. But they do find out something in this issue, that Dylan Brock isn't or might not be what he says he is or what everyone thinks he is. Because Sleeper, who is the... This is where it gets a bit weird. Sleeper is the name of a symbiote who is... the guy inside him is basically the Kree guy who had the Venom symbiote first.
Boy, you are looking at me like I have any idea what these words you're saying.
Yeah, I know. It all gets confusing. But Sleeper is basically the seventh spawn of Venom's seventh spawn, which, as soon as I read that, I went, hang on, isn't that a Pratchett reference? Yeah,
that's a sorcerer.
It's the eighth son of the eighth son, a wizard squared, a sorcerer. Yeah. He's a source of magic. You know, as soon as he described himself as the seventh spawn of the seventh spawn of Venom, I was like, okay, that explains why they're so different. And Sleeper, he can think for himself. He's completely separate from everybody. And he kind of becomes Dylan's pet cat. But he knows the truth about what Dylan is, and he wants Dylan to tell Eddie exactly what he is. But Dylan also finds out at the end of this that Eddie is actually his dad. And so the two of them kind of end this with Dylan keeping his secret, but the two of them trying to process that now they're not older brother, younger brother, they're basically father and son. And then you get to Absolute Carnage versus Deadpool, which, well...
Well, that must be straightforward and sensible.
No. See, not only do you have Deadpool doing his very best to kind of muddy the waters, you have Spider-Man also doing his very best as Deadpool's favourite pal to muddy the waters. They have a very Deadpool 2 moment in this where the bottom half of Deadpool gets stuck to the ceiling and so Spider-Man has to look after him while he's going through the baby legs phase. But you also have the writers of this. Carnage realises that Deadpool is basically a unicorn. Deadpool's the only one who's merged with four symbiotes at once. At which point, you have a little side note from Jake T going, 5 if you count Deadpool back in black. And then another message saying, we don't, from Devin. And Jake T replying, get out of my book, Devin. So you got the writers throwing in pithy comments like that just because they can. It's a bizarre situation where Deadpool becomes Carnage's most sought after. and Carnage only wants the spines because apparently that's where the symbiote codex is. Deadpool wants Spider-Man just to be his best bud. Which then leads on to, well, it leads on to a Captain Marvel story.
Sure.
Is it one where someone tries to steal Captain Marvel's powers by any chance?
Yes. In this case, it's Carnage who tries to steal Captain Marvel's powers by infecting her cat, or her, what is it, what's it called? A Flurkin? Flurmin?
Flurkin.
Flurkin. So anyway, Carol's in space fighting a giant space monster. More tentacles. So she's fighting a giant space monster, but before she fights that, she basically grounds herself by watching videos of her cat, her Flurkin. That sounds wrong.
Video. Hold on. You can get all the videos of Captain Marvel's Flurkin. Is that what you're telling us? What corners of the internet have you been going to?
Marvel corners. So anyway, Carol's worried because her neighbor keeps feeding her pet cat, or overfeeding her pet cat. And when she gets back, she finds out that her cat has suddenly turned into that because it's been infected by Carnage.
Yeah, that's not going to work on an audio format.
Yeah, her cat has basically gone from fluffy cat, fluffy kind of tabby cat to red tentacled demonic thing with bright yellow eyes. And
which
also,
all cats eventually descend into.
Which also has tentacle mouth, which then swallows Carol Danvers. When I say swallows, I mean literally... So Carol ends up in the pocket dimension inside her cat. Stop me if you've heard this one. Carol's in the pocket dimension of her cat, trying not to lose herself and having to fight the Carnage symbiote in the pocket dimension of her cat, which then begs the question, if she's fighting the Carnage in the pocket dimension, what is it that's actually infecting her cat?
My brain hurts.
Yeah, so does mine.
You know sometimes when people tell you that they've tried to get into comics, but they just can't.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe they shouldn't.
Yeah. See.
Maybe that's the new message of 4 pounds. Don't read comics.
Yeah. See, this is the thing. Carnage keeps trying to take over Carol Danvers, but then she goes with a massive full-body photon blast type thing.
Again?
Yeah.
Standard Carol.
Then she's got her cat back, but when she leaves Earth again, she leaves her cat with somebody else because she can't trust her neighbour. And then it goes on to loads of artwork and then little stories towards the end, like Black Cat and her cats. She traps this rat who's been infected by Carnage, chucks out the window. You got Peter Parker who's eating a pizza, only to have part of his pizza stolen by a Carnage-infested pigeon.
Are you saying that Peter Parker picked a piece of pizza?
And then a pigeon stole it. You have Carol Danvers' cat chasing a Carnage-infected mouse, only to find that all the mice have been infected by Carnage. Oh, and you also have a last bit with Deadpool, which is a nice way to end it, which then brings us back to Absolute Carnage. See what I mean about this?
I thought we were getting to the end there.
I
saw light at the end of the tunnel.
We are basically at the end, right?
I had a hole. Thanks for listening, everyone.
We are basically at the end. See, this is one of those really weird, bizarre things. The ongoing theme through Absolute Carnage is that Eddie wants to protect his son at all costs. But they've set this up for another massive crossover thing.
Because comics.
No, because comics, and because they basically made Eddie Brock a character who will literally do anything to protect his son, except tell the truth.
So he would do anything for love.
But he won't do that.
Yes.
It's fine. How about we'll say, well, make the last episode of 4 Panel the week New Mutants comes out.
And not only that, Eddie Brock, in his new Venom thing, has wings like a bat out of hell.
See, we didn't even know that.
We didn't.
That's how good we are now.
And Carnage also has bat-like wings, because apparently they must have them. Eddie has basically screwed the pooch with how he's handled things. Instead of asking for help and instead of telling the truth, he's done what he usually does and tried to deal with things on his own. And by doing that, he's basically made things worse. Because, you know that thing that everyone was trying to avoid?
No, I don't. I've had no idea what's been going on for like the past 15 minutes, Rob.
Well, if
I think I've made that abundantly clear.
When you listen back to the episode, if you do listen back to the episode, you'll know that you'll know what that thing that everyone was trying to avoid was. And that's all I'm going to say, because it's easily foreshadowed. Is it another spin-off book?
I bet it's another spin-off book.
It's going to be another crossover. They've already foreshadowed it. They've been building up to this since they first mentioned it in one of the Venom comics, and then they did Venomverse. It's going to be a big fight between the God Null and all of the heroes on Earth.
It's going to be Civil War of the Carnage Realms.
No, I'm done.
Two.
Basically, yeah, it's literally going to be that. Oh, look, you have a primeval god. You must fight against this primeval god.
I missed one. It's going to be Secret Civil War of the Realms, of the Carnage Realms.
Two.
Secret Civil War of the Carnage Realms verse two.
Dark Invasion.
Dark Invasion
call. End it now, Andrew. And end it now.
Well, that's it for us, everyone. We are at the end of the show. If you'd like to hear more of us, you can find us on all good podcast apps, or you can listen to us directly on thegeekshow.co.uk. If you want to follow us, you can follow us at The Geek Show on Twitter and Facebook. And if you really want to help us continue to do this thing, which we love doing, you can donate on our Patreon.
We've actually changed our format a little bit. So the comics side of 4Panel is now fortnightly, and we will mainly be covering comics on that. We also have our brother-sister show.
Yes, it's our brother-sister-wife show.
Yeah. Called Behold, which is also fortnightly, and will run alternately to 4Panel. Yeah,
and can be found on its own special Twitter channel, at BeholdPod.
Yep. So until the next 4Panel, I've been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And I've been Mick.
And we will see you all later.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye now.